special here.
There we go. All right, Blue Eye Special's on. This hearing of the Senate Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I always do, I like reading from the voices of the guard. These are homecoming poems that they write, and they're all they're from our Oregon National Guard. And this chapter is talismans, and lucky charms. That's easier to say. And this is written by either a man or a woman, but probably a man. My best friend in the world, he was actually in the invasion into Iraq. And as soon as he came back and was getting out of the army, I was leaving. He and his mom came to my deployment ceremony, and she gave me one of those soldiers' pocket Bibles. It was an army emblem on the front, and I actually kept that in a Ziploc bag, and I kept that in my assault pack. I carried that with me on every mission. I guess it's a reminder. I try to remind myself that God's with us everywhere we go. It made me feel better. And then he writes another paragraph like he's talking out the other side of his mouth. You know what? I did have a lucky baseball cap that I always carried in the bottom of my backpack. It was just a really neat old hat that I'd had forever, and I threw it in there just because. It was tan. It had a subdued brown embroidered American flag on the front, and on the back of it, it had embroidered on it, "We do bad things to bad people." I love that hat, like a little bit of inspiration. And then he ends by saying, "I'm a walking contradiction." Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. There's a lot of people thinking some of us veterans are walking contradictions, that's for sure. Let me outline the committee hearing for today. We're going to do a very quick work session because, as you know, paperwork, we're in a 30-day rush session. I think somebody said it was the Thunderbolt session on the House the other day, or the Turbo session or something like that. And so we need to get one of these bills that needs to get processed out of the committee and going, and that's SB 1561. And then we're going to go back and kind of jump a little bit back and forth between the two Senate bills on public hearings as there are representatives and senators that want to testify. And then we'll work backwards from there, and then any work additional work sessions will be done at the end of the meeting. I will say that the two House measure or House memorials we may actually move today because they're not substantive matters, but House Bill 4064 will not move today. Its work session will be scheduled if there is one for next week. With that, I'm going to open a work session on SB 561. Madam Counselor.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 1561 modifies the Homeland Security Council structure and aligns it with HJR 7 from 2011 if that HJR 7 is approved by voters. That measure will be decided by the voters in November of 2012. It will revise the Oregon Constitution to authorize certain actions by the governor and the Legislative Assembly during a catastrophic disaster. And should it pass, this measure, Senate Bill 1561, would require the Homeland Security Council to receive briefings regarding same.
Madam Vice Chair.
What do you want me to do?
Motion.
Are we really ready to move it?
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1561 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonus Anderson moves SB 1561 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'd point out this is the one, this particular bill is attached to the ballot measure that's on the ballot this fall. Homeland Security Council is always a work in progress, and there are some, you know, more updates coming in the next session in February. Further discussion, Madam Vice Chair? Senator Olson? Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Anderson. Aye.
Chair Boquist.
Aye. And for the record, Senator Courtney is excused. Motion carries, and I'll carry it on the floor. With that, I'm going to close the work session on SB 561. And looking out here in the crowd, I see Rep. Sheehan, and that is SB 1559. I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 1559, ask that Rep. Sheehan come forward and discuss the Dash 4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and happy Tuxedo Tuesday from the House. My name is Patrick Sheehan, and I am the representative from House District 51. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 1559-4 amendments. These are identical to a House Bill 4051, which died for reasons unrelated to its content. Oregon has a 911 tax. You pay 75 cents a month on your land and mobile lines that go to pay for 911 to be ready to answer your emergency call. The tax is collected on your phone bill, and it goes to the Office of Emergency Management, who allocates the funds to 246 cities and counties based on a per capita equation that does not change in any way with this bill. The cities and counties are required to send the money to their 911 centers either by writing another check or asking the Office of Emergency Management to fund them directly. All this bill does is take away the middleman by having every distribution go directly to the 911 centers from the Office of Emergency Management. So this creates a modest efficiency that's already proven to work. Two-thirds of the cities and counties actually do it this way already, but it's voluntary. This creates greater transparency by making reporting consistent, and it has overwhelming support from public safety interests. In front of you should have a bunch of letters from the Clackamas County Sheriff, the Clackamas County Fire Chief, the Portland Fire Chief, and several others. In fact, my division chief from Portland Fire, John Norris, here, and he's submitting some testimony as well. The bill does not take away the city's and county's discretion in where to send these funds, nor does it prevent them from consolidating or sharing services. The bill also does not affect the tax rate in any way. According to an email from Gary Blackburn from the Secretary of State's office, there are 246 entities which are eligible for these payments, and all but 79 elect to have the funds distributed directly. Not only will this bill save us money in streamlining government payments for public safety, it will prevent confusion. In a letter dated December 15th of 2010, Shannon Marine, the Director of Technology and Response for Office of Emergency Management, stated that looking over these budget reports, the analyst was finding some suspected deficiencies as to the proper budgeting of 911 excise tax, as required under local budget law. She went on to say, as Office of Emergency Management is responsible for reporting to the legislature for the expenditure of the 911 tax, it is very important that the proper budgeting of the tax is followed and that the results are as transparent as possible. So according to Clackamas County Fire, up to $500,000 of dedicated funding each year is not reaching the public safety answering point and must be made up for in user fees. Direct funding of 911 solves the problem. And I welcome any questions.
Appreciate you bringing this forward. Questions from committee members at this point? I see nobody moving. Thank you very much. I see Paul Snyder. You're on the dash four, correct? If you'd come up, and I know there's got to be someone here from the cities, but they're not signed up. So why doesn't the cities come up too? And I'm not putting the two of you on the spot. I'm just expecting other senators and representatives. I'm only calling two of you up, so if senators and representatives come in that have to rush back out, they can testify right after you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And I first took a look at the dash fours about 4 minutes ago. They appear to me, and I asked Representative Sheehan to say no, if that's not the case, but they looked to me to be House Bill 4051 in the form of an amendment. And if that's the case, and if the language is exactly the same, then the concern that we raised with respect to House Bill 4051 continues. One of these issues would have to do with the language of the bill. And it appears to change the statute to say that the Oregon Emergency Management is to pay funds on a per capita basis to cities and counties, I'm paraphrasing, on the basis of each county's unincorporated area for distribution directly to 911. But it's not direct distribution to 911 jurisdictions. It's still distribution to cities and counties for distribution directly to 911 jurisdictions. I think, frankly, the language is awkward and somewhat confusing. So if the purpose is to directly pay the 911 jurisdictions, I don't think this language accomplishes that purpose. And it raises the issue with us, as we've mentioned in the past, whose responsibility is it to assure that the funds are used for the purposes stated in the statute? Is it the city? Is it the county? Is it the 911 jurisdiction? Or is it some combination of those things? And frankly, if accountability is an issue, then responsibility and liability is also an issue. So those are the issues that we have that are of concern to us. We don't object to the purposes of the bill, and we've mentioned that to the sponsor and to members on the House side. Our concern is the language doesn't appear to accomplish the purpose. It raises issues that are still unaddressed. And I think it would be something worthwhile working on during the interim, along with the other 911 issues that have been raised before.
Thank you, Paul.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. The League also has some concerns with the amendment for the reasons that my colleague, Mr. Snyder, raised. We're also concerned with a couple of other aspects. The language directly to the 911, paying directly to the 911 jurisdictions is potentially problematic, and here's why. There's no dispute resolution process that I'm aware of, and the bill doesn't direct one. If a PSAP believes that they're entitled to a check on behalf of the city and the city wishes to contract with another provider, this isn't a hypothetical. We have a situation brewing in a coastal region of the state where some 911 subscriber agencies are contemplating moving to a valley PSAP for efficiencies and for greater costs. This simply determines directly to the 911 jurisdictions. Directly to the 911 jurisdictions, as determined by whom? Is it OEM? Is it the city? Is it the county? Is it the PSAP? And what happens if there's a conflict and the PSAP says there's a contractual obligation on behalf of the city and the city disputes? We believe that this language could create conflicts down the road. I would also note that the OEM is required to conduct an annual report to look at 911 revenues and ensure that they're expended. I think that should be entered into the record so the committee would have that ability to see what's actually happening, where's that money going. I understand that there have been some issues raised.
Our 911 system is not working here, so let's hope there's no fire.
Okay. So, for these reasons, I think we have some concerns. We do not, as I've testified in front of this committee before, we have no desire to see 911 funds diverted. We are foursquare opposed to that, as I may have mentioned earlier this session. But we believe that this concept requires further consideration and work.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Madam Vice Chair?
Explain to me how in Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview, okay, right now the funds are being distributed to all four cities?
Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, correct.
And about how much of money is that at ballpark?
Typically the city will receive between 20% and 33% of their 911 obligations from the 911 tax. I don't know off the top of my head how much that it is for all four of those cities.
Okay, and it'd be nice to know what kind of monies we're talking about here. But who is our 911 jurisdiction? So where would that money go to?
Senator Boquist, Chair Montes Anderson, all four of the cities you mentioned are subscribers to BOAC, Bureau of Emergency Communications, which is run by Portland, City of Portland.
Thank you.
Follow-up question myself, just so I understand here, because even since 2005, this is like jumping into a piranha bathtub when you start talking 911. But what follow-up to Senator Manos Anderson's question, so I understand here. You have three or four different cities getting the funds, and then they're then in turn forwarding, in theory, the funds to BOAC, you said?
Correct.
Okay, great.
So, I mean, I know we're talking about accountability. Is that a slush fund where cities can keep a certain amount and not maybe transfer all of it?
Chair Boquist, Senator Manos Anderson, I'm unclear as to what the financial motive of a city would be to do that, because as I pointed out, that the 911 tax pays between 20% and a third of their total 911 obligation. So the city would then have to make up that amount from another source if they diverted. The state has been a junior partner, financially speaking, in every PSAP in the state, in every 911 relationship. It's paying only a portion of those costs. The rest are being borne by the local government.
Well, it still would be nice to know, you know, what is the accounting of the cities, and I would love to know how much from my cities, and, you know, there has to be a paper trail, so someone has that information.
Chair Boquist, Senator Manos Anderson, there is, and it's usually contained in their annual performance audit, but I can look up that information and pull the OEM report and get that to your office if you'd like.
Thank you.
Sarah Olson, question.
How many PSEPs do we have in the state?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, 49.
Using Senator Manos Anderson's example, she has four cities that you cut checks to. Add that up over the entire state, we probably cut over 200 checks. Wouldn't it be easier and cheaper to cut 49?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, yes, I think it would be easier from an OEM perspective, from the perspective of the service provider who is looking at a changing 911 system. I think that creates certain complications. And so what's not in the amendment before the committee is a dispute resolution process. If an agency decides that there is over-capitalization, 911 capitalization in the region, and that is happening in some places, where is the, and that city decides we want to contract with, arbitrary example, Willamette Valley PSAP out of Salem. If the current subscriber agency has a dispute with where that money should go, how do we resolve that conflict?
Follow
so
up.
I think that does create a certain challenge when we look at, potentially creates a certain challenge when we look at efforts to consolidate.
Follow up.
So what you're saying is that, for example, and once again, Senator Lori Manos Anderson's example, you're saying that Gresham might want to come to Salem, the Salem PSAP, and use the Salem facilities instead of Multnomah County?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I'm not clear why Gresham would want to go to Salem, but I represent all 242 cities statewide basis. In Portland, you have a highly consolidated, upgraded next-gen system. Portland isn't the issue so much in my mind. It's in those smaller jurisdictions downstate where an agency might choose to go with CECOM as opposed to a smaller PSAP at some point. How do we address that? And who determines where that money goes?
Follow up,
please.
Well, if we get into a smaller situation than something down on the coast or something like that, your contention is then if a city wants to change and go to a different PSAP, that they should be able to direct those funds to the PSAP they want it to. So why couldn't we just set it up where if Florence, where there is a PSAP, say Reedsport wants to switch and go south, why can't we just OEM send that check south instead of sending it to Reedsport and then have them ship it south?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, as I read the bill, it requires the amendment before the committee. It simply says directly to the PSAP. It doesn't state which PSAP.
Right. Well, my point is, if Reedsport uses Florence as a PSAP, and they would typically, Reedsport would send a check to the Florence PSAP, is that not correct? They would be paid.
That would be the typical arrangement.
They would send a check. So instead of sending in lieu of a check, why couldn't they just tell OEM that, oh, by the way, we're not going to use Florence anymore. We're going to use Cottage Grove. And and those funds are removed from Florence, the Florence PSAP, and sent to the Cottage Grove PSAP.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, under the current statute, they can do that now. They can make that selection. The way I read the amendment, it simply says directly to the PSAP jurisdiction, and the 911 jurisdiction, and it doesn't. The selection process is what I think we need to work on, continue to discuss, and develop some form of dispute resolution if a PSAP believes that they're entitled to that check and the agent, subscriber agency would like to go somewhere else.
Okay, we're going to move on. Gentlemen, don't disappear because we're going to come back to this topic. So I'd appreciate it if you stay in the hearing room. The only comment I'd have is one of the challenges we have, and both of you know this, is as you pointed out, you have 242 cities and Paul has 36 counties. And I track the counties more than I track the cities, but in the counties, you know, with all those county commissioners, they're not all necessarily on board with the association. And behind the scenes, since 2005, I have mayors and council members and commissioners coming to me saying, hey, we got to do something different because it ain't working the way it's supposed to financially, as we all know. So we're going to come back to this issue. So I appreciate you, gentlemen, your testimony. Mike Dewey.
Thank you.
Mike, are you on for or against? Because you didn't check the block.
And I'm not on this one.
Okay, got it. Fine. Hasina Squires, General Caldwell, I think you have a comment of neutrality probably on this one. And Representative Sheehan, if you'd like to come back up to answer a couple of these questions, since this is a House amendment, not a Senate amendment. And I think if you don't mind, and you said you had time, Representative Sheehan, I'll let the neutral person go first, and then I'll let the pro person go second, and then come back to you, Representative Sheehan, if that's okay. That way you can, I guess, claim wrap-up here on this amendment.
Thank you.
General Caldwell, if you would, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm a Deputy Director at the Military Department and also the Interim Head of Emergency Management. Again, we, as I testified in the House, we currently send out 276 checks to the various jurisdictions. Some of them have done some consolidation with respect to their checks. Many of them have not. Currently, we have...
Mr. Chair, now what do you mean by that?
Madam Chairman, or Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, as was indicated in the previous testimony, cities and counties can now make that decision if they choose not to have a line item in their budget and they want to send it to a specific PSAP, they can choose to do that. There's very few of them that have done that, but that is possible. So that's what I mean by that remark. Otherwise, if you do the math, 242 and 36, but we're sending out 276 checks, so there's only a couple of them that have done it. And I think they've done that, the smaller ones, because of auditing and just having the capability in the smaller jurisdictions to follow the appropriate audit rules. So I would offer some changes to this slight. Line 22, page 3, we have the language is a little bit confusing. And I think for our purposes, if this bill passes, then we would like to see the word distribute on line 22 X'd out and replaced with allocate. In essence, what it says is we'll distribute in that paragraph, we say we'll distribute twice. And I think that's confusing, so we would allocate to the different jurisdictions. We would distribute to the 911 PSAPs. If this is passed, the same thing applies in line 26, where it says each county must receive a minimum of 1%. Again, I think we need to change that to allocate, so we allocate it to them, but it actually is received at that PSAP. So I think it clarifies that section of the law that will at least make it clear for us. So there is absolutely no confusion that we're allocating a certain amount, but it's actually being sent to a specific PSAP. Currently, there's, as I said, there's 276 different jurisdictions we send it out to. Warm Springs is the 49th PSAP we have right now. We have a consolidation going on. By the 1st of March, we'll be down to 48, and we do not distribute to Warm Springs. So we would be down to 47 checks from 276. to answer Senator Olson's earlier question. Those are the only comments that I have. Unless you have questions of me, I will turn it over to the expert.
Good morning, Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Mona Sanderson, and members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Oregon chapter of APCO NENA, an organization that represents the 911 centers throughout the state of Oregon. What you've heard is confusion, and I'd just like to clear this bill up. It's a very, very simple bill. I also represent the Special Districts Association. We support the bill. The Oregon Fire Districts Association, Fire District Directors Association, which makes up the elected officials that are elected to fire district boards, support this legislation. I believe you have a letter from the City of Portland, one of League of Oregon City's largest members, also supporting this legislation. It's very simple. This is a good government streamlining bill. This doesn't do anything to change the money how it is calculated to cities and counties. They will still get their same allocation. They'll get an allocation, but it will be distributed directly to the 911 centers. The way that this could work without a dispute resolution process is in the administrative rulemaking process, OEM could just tell all of the cities and counties, please indicate which PSAP you are going to have your money sent to, and the money would be sent straight there. There's no reason to have 276 checks cut to all these cities and counties when the money is just turned over to the 911 centers. Those are the people I represent. We get the money anyway, and we use it only for 911 purposes. A benefit to this piece of legislation would also be less auditing trail. Cities and counties are all required to comply with an annual audit. 911 centers are also audited, so there's double auditing that could be occurring, and this would be a much more simple paper trail that would be created by passage of this legislation. General Caldwell's point on the two technical amendments, distribute the money or allocate the money. Yeah, they're getting allocated the money. The money would then be distributed to the PSAP. So we don't have any objection and concur with him on the change that might need to be made in the House. But we urge you to pass this piece of legislation on. It's good government. It's streamlining. And it saves taxpayer dollars.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. Senator Olson, you asked about whether or not they would be able to allocate money to a different PSAP, and the testimony from the League of Oregon Cities was unclear that they would not. That's false. They absolutely have the ability to allocate wherever they want. The bill actually adds one word to the existing statute, and that's directly. It takes away a couple of the voluntary things of getting the check in, but adding one word is not going to change how it allocates the funds. So the answer to your question is they would absolutely retain the right to go to whichever PSAP or consolidate with whatever PSAP that they have. Senator Mona Sanderson, you asked about allocations to some cities. Gresham, this is a quarterly distribution. Gresham gets $133,000. Troutdale gets $20,000. Wood Village, $4,800. And what was the other city?
Fairview.
I'm sorry, these are not alphabetical. Fairview gets $11,000, and that's a quarterly distribution.
Thank you. Interesting.
Other questions so we can move on? Senator Olson.
Representative Sheehan, you realize this kills a great bill that I had working, don't you?
We haven't done anything yet.
I know.
I'm very sorry that this kills a great bill, and I look forward to supporting your bill when it comes back.
But actually, this is a piece of the work that we need to get done. And it's a good piece, and I would ask General Caldwell, I assume you're for and against, right?
Neutral, right?
Yeah, you're neutral. We've talked about this. This will benefit your agency in the regard to cutting all those checks, putting all the manpower in. But my question is, what about oversight? How do we make sure that the PSAP is spending the money on PSAP money and not on Valentine's gifts?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, as was indicated in other testimonies, annually each jurisdiction, city, county has to have an audit, and they have to report those findings to the Secretary of State. That's one of the audit items. We've routinely conversed with the Secretary of State and emphasized this exact point. Are we are these folks, you know, are they looking at this and are they spending the money properly? So we don't have an audit system per se out of OEM. It's not our function, but it is a check and a balance that's constantly done at the local level, and they're and they use that as an emphasis point.
Is there any consequences for a PSAP if they use the money incorrectly?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'm not aware of any fines or such inside the actual statute. However, there is other audit statutes that dictate if you don't do it, then you actually have to pay back a different fund.
Okay.
You got to shift money out of one fund to pay back another fund. Say, for instance, if a jurisdiction decided to put $100,000 because they had it sitting in their 911 account that they didn't use, which it won't be the case in the larger PSAPs because they're already probably 80% of the load is being paid by the local government. Some of the smaller ones that could occur, and let's say they put it into a park, then that's a violation of the law. If it was found in the audit, then they would be instructed to take money out of their general fund and repay the 911 fund.
One final question. Short, please. Very short. And for the PSAP folks, don't take it that I'm trying to talk consolidation, but if we consolidate, this will simplify the consolidation system, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, indeed, like I said, anything that we can do to limit the cost of sending these checks out is, of course, simplification and cost savings. We estimate right now that this would save somewhere between $5,000 and $8,000 annually in the quarterly check distribution, just in the mailing costs and the handling costs and that sort of thing. It's not a huge amount of money, but it is money.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on 1559 for the moment, and we're going to come back to it. We're going to open a public hearing on 1563 for the purpose of amendments, and ask Senator Haas and his colleagues to come forward so that they can testify, and then we'll move on with there.
Paperwork.
And would you tee us up on 1563?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1563 is the one that extends certain state law protections and benefits that are available to military service personnel, to members of the Commissioned Corps of the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration. The Dash 3 Amendment requires community colleges to follow guidelines that are similar to universities with regard to offering free tuition to dependents of deceased service members.
I'm assuming the senator, being the ranking member, is going to go first.
Thank you, Senator Bonquist and committee members. Mark Haas, state senator from District 14. I'm here today just to ask for your consideration of an amendment to Senate Bill 1563. And I don't want to comment on the bill itself, but I want to ask that you think about this amendment. And I'd like to give you, if I can, a very brief history of how we got here with this amendment. In the very first experimental short session in 2008, this body passed a bill that would allow universities in Oregon to waive tuition to widows and orphans of fallen GIs. And at the time when this was going through the legislature, the university said they could do this through kind of an open seat policy where they could absorb a pretty small universe of people without any cost. There was no fiscal. But community colleges said, wait, we can't do that because we have a different system. And besides, we already have lots of programs that vary throughout our 17 community colleges. And so we didn't include community colleges. During the first couple of years during the university system, it was successful with those people that participated. But veterans groups started sharing their frustration with me and others that the community colleges weren't really holding up their end of the bargain, and that some did and some didn't, with varied results, help these widows and orphans of people who had lost their lives in the line of service. And so last year, in the 2011 session, we had a bill, Senate Bill 338, to say to community colleges that you'll waive tuition too, just like the universities did. And we had this situation where community colleges, I believe, were genuinely trying to do the right thing, but they couldn't all get on the same page. And some of the veterans who were employed by community colleges came to this hearing and including a community college president who was a decorated vet, and said, we're trying our best. And it was very emotional, and you had this difficult situation that was really veterans against veterans. The compromise was drawn, all right, we'll have a task force of community college presidents meet and figure this out. And if they don't have it figured out by the 2012 special session, then we'll push this bill forward. So they did get together, the community college presidents, and from what I had heard, that they had fixed this and they had resolved this. And so we didn't draft a bill. Their report came out in January after the bill drafting deadlines, which essentially said that there's already a federal program that provides federal scholarships for these same people. Why would we waive tuition if we can get this federal money? I'm oversimplifying this a bit, and you'll hear more from it when the community colleges come up. And but when you talk to veterans, you hear a couple of things, like the federal program that provides a scholarship money and doesn't necessarily include tuition, that it's lengthy and bureaucratic and takes time, and there's no reason you can't do both. And I go back and forth, and I'm trying, you know, as a chair of the Senate Education Committee, to be judicious. We have to look after community colleges and meet their needs too. But what I've kind of concluded over the last month of back and forth is what we are doing here is quibbling. We're quibbling about how to help orphans and widows of people who lost their lives in the defense of our country. And we don't need to do that. And so this amendment just says, when this person comes to a community college and says, my father or my husband lost his life, the community college simply waives tuition. And I think that is the least that this state can do for people who find themselves in this circumstance, and it is a way of saying, thank you, your education is on us. And that's what the Dash 3s do to Senate Bill 1563.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. Thank you for the opportunity just to support my senator and some constituents in asking for your consideration of the Dash 3 amendments. I don't have a lot to add to what Senator Haas said, but I've had the opportunity to work on some higher ed issues over the last few years, and one thing that I've developed is a new appreciation for what a difference higher education can make in people's lives. One statistic that has stuck with me came from the fall of 2010 when the unemployment rate in the country as a whole was 9.8%. Among college graduates, it was 4.1%, and among women who are college graduates, it was 2%. So combine that reality with the reality that we have an opportunity to help people who have sacrificed for our state and our country, and I would just echo the comments that Senator Haas made about how this is an easy opportunity to make things a bit better. There's a lot of other work that we need to do, but here's an opportunity to improve things modestly, and I hope you'll take that chance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions?
Before you, the two of you gentlemen disappear, let me ask staff a question here. The difference in the A3 and the A4 amendments, is there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 4 amendment was actually a recommendation of the drafter. She noticed that the applicability provision was missing from the underlying measure. It's standalone and doesn't affect the Dash 3.
All right, so it doesn't impact you. All right, gentlemen, if there's no questions, appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Val Conley and Robert Thornhill to come up, if you would, please. And then from there, we'll move on to the community colleges. I don't have four seats, or I would have brought you up, so. Ladies first.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Conley. I am the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today to provide information regarding the Dash 3 amendment being proposed that impacts the implementation of the dependent tuition waiver offered by the community colleges. As you may know, last week, the Task Force on Tuition Waivers for Dependents of Fallen and Disabled Soldiers presented its final report to the House Veterans Committee. ODVA presented an addendum to the report highlighting areas where ODVA disagreed with the task force. I do not believe we can discuss the Dash 3 amendment without understanding why the legislature created the task force last session through Senate Bill 338. When the legislature established the tuition waiver program for the survivors of service members killed in action and the dependents of 100% service-connected veterans in 2008, the bill only applied to the Oregon University system and not the community colleges. The community colleges agreed to implement the waiver on their own. Every session since then, veterans groups and advocates have brought forth grievances regarding the implementation of the waiver at the community colleges and proposed legislation to remedy it. Senate Bill 338 was one of those remedies. In its original form, Senate Bill 338 did what the Senate Bill 1563-3 amendments do. It placed the community colleges in statute, arguing that the colleges had not really hit the mark with their own policies. Senate Bill 338 was amended to allow the colleges one last chance at establishing a common tuition waiver policy across the 17 campuses. And Senate Bill 338 had one more requirement. The task force was to align the eligibility policy with that of the Oregon University system. Unfortunately, according to the mandate of Senate Bill 338, ODVA thinks the task force also missed the mark because its report does not align with the Oregon University system in one significant area when the waiver should be implemented. The Oregon University system applies the waiver to what they call first dollar, meaning that the dependent's tuition is waived before any other money is applied. The task force reported that the community colleges would differ from the OUS in this respect and apply the waiver last dollar, meaning a survivor or dependent will need to exhaust all other means of federal student aid, including a federal VA survivor and dependent benefit called Dependents Educational Assistance, or DEA. This is another point where ODVA and the task force disagreed. DEA is an allowance that is available to survivors and dependents while enrolled in a VA-approved school. The benefit is paid directly to the dependent and not the college. DEA is not a tuition program, rather an allowance meant to help the dependent pay for many different expenses, including subsistence expenses, tuition, fees, and books. Let me note that while we have some disagreement on this policy, we still consider the community colleges our partners in supporting student veterans. We all want to do the right thing. I believe Chair Witt put it best when he noted during committee that ODVA and the community colleges have different constituencies and concern, which is why we are not seeing eye to eye. I believe he is correct. ODVA is focused on the veterans, their survivors, and dependents because that is our mission. The community colleges have a broader focus due to their different mission. We understand this. That said, we believe that placing the community colleges in statute along with OUS as proposed by the Dash 3 amendment is what should have occurred when the tuition waiver policy was implemented in 2008. I would note that the Dash 3 amendment does make a change to the eligibility when compared to the original statute. Specifically, it changes the eligibility of the waiver from those who died of a service-connected disability to those who died of a 100% service-connected disability and eliminates the dependence of those veterans who are rated 100% service-connected disabled. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate all the work you've done on this bill. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Thornhill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Robert Thornhill. I appear before you in support of Senate Bill 1563-2. Doing so, it is my honor to privilege to speak for the members of VFW Post 1442. I've submitted written testimony. Thank you. But with your permission, I'll summarize.
Appreciate it.
Next to fallen soldiers themselves, no one is given more in America's wars than the children and spouses. In recognition of their sacrifices, in 2008, the Oregon Legislature enacted what I shall refer to as the Tuition Waiver Program. This gift from the people of Oregon will not bring back or make whole their loved ones. It will, however, give the intended recipients a chance at an education they might not otherwise be able to attain. OUS Chancellor Pernsteiner supported the legislation establishing this program, and under his leadership, it has been successfully implemented by Oregon universities. Extensive efforts have been made without success to coax the community colleges to implement tuition waiver programs in line with the statutes. That is Oregon Revised Statutes 351.656. The last effort, SB 338, also failed. While the Community College Association and the Task Force of College Presidents clearly understood and accepted the charge of SB 338, the task force failed to fulfill that charge. As shown in my written testimony, there has not been established a uniform tuition waiver program by all 17 community colleges that is in line with the Oregon Revised Statute 351.656, which is the basic charge of SB 338. For a variety of reasons, many students prefer to at least start their post-secondary education at community college level. The students involved in this program should be given the option of a community college. Oregon needs the graduates of both the four-year college as well as the community college. As explained in my written testimony, Marine Gunnery Sergeant John D. Fry Scholarship Program has reduced significantly the number of eligible for the waiver program. However, to ensure the remaining eligible students have the option of a community college, I urge a committee to approve SB 1563-2. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to testify. My colleagues at 1442 directed that I thank you for all the good things you do here for veterans as well as for all the citizens of Oregon, and to wish you a happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you.
I'll be trying to answer any questions.
And thank you for your service to the country, and thank the veterans in your post for their service to the country.
Thank you, sir.
Questions?
Yes.
Madam Vice Chair.
How many fallen soldiers' families or dependents would this affect? Is it just the last two wars, or does it go back to...
Chair Boquist, Senator Mona Sanderson, we have approximately 132 names on our Iraq-Afghanistan wall, so... This would impact the survivors of those veterans.
But that we don't go back before
then. It could virtually include dependents of spouses, anyway, of probably back to Vietnam era veterans.
That's what I wanted to know. Thank
who
you.
Probably at this point in their lives wouldn't be interested in going to school and taking advantage of the tuition waiver.
They're also.
I noticed on some information we got here that children are eligible to age 23 for most of the community colleges, but they seem to be singling out the wives or the spouses, if you will, that they cannot be remarried or must apply within 10 years. Do you find that a little disingenuous?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I was surprised that there was no established eligibility cutoff date for spouses because in VA law, in the dependents programs they have for spouses, there is, I believe, a 10 or 12 year window from date of death of the veteran in which they can apply to use that benefit. So this bill left that wide open, and so I was very surprised by that.
Follow myself, and current law does the same, correct? Okay. Other question?
Correct.
I appreciate both of your testimonies. Thank you very much. And again, I thank you for your service to the country. And with that, I'm going to call Krista Caldwell and John Wyckoff to come up.
Thank you.
We're trying. Wrap up the testimony on this one, and then we'll probably take a 5-minute recess to use the bathroom because we're some of us are old people and we drank too much coffee this morning. If you're thinking our technology is going to work here, good luck.
I'm starting to think it may.
There we go. Oh,
there we go.
Good morning, Senator Boquist and members of the committee. My name is Carissa Caldwell, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I've been asked to provide information this morning on the background of the tuition waivers at Oregon Community Colleges for spouses and dependents of fallen and disabled soldiers. The task force report requested in Senate Bill 338 from the 2011 session and the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 1563. Currently, Oregon's community colleges offer a waiver that serves as a safety net for students who do not receive other sources of federal student aid or other federal benefits that are adequate to cover the cost of tuition. To address the concerns about process, Senate Bill 338 established a task force made up of the community college presidents to determine what it would take to align community college tuition waivers with OUS. One task force meeting was convened in December 2011 for the presidents to consult with Mr. Mann and Ms. Heff of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I represented the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development as staff to the task force. The ODVA representatives were available and brought plenty of materials to support the requests and information with the presidents. When this concept was first passed in 2008, the Senate Education General Government Committee directed OUS to create a program with minimal fiscal impact so the bill would not require referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Community colleges asked not to be included in the bill because community college tuition is set by locally elected, locally governed boards, unlike OUS. OUS told the committee that they would adopt a program for open seats only to keep the cost minimal. Community colleges' governance and financial models are very different from OUS. For the colleges, using an open seat criteria is unreasonable for the student and difficult for the college to administer. However, when OUS implemented the program, it was implemented as a full waiver with no restrictions, resulting in significant fiscal impact. Community colleges adopted programs applying federal financial aid prior to applying a waiver, but there were variations among the 17 locally governed college programs. In order to keep costs low, federal aid was applied first. This approach is known as last dollar. Colleges created programs as a true safety net intended to catch those who slip through the cracks with other forms of financial aid. In previous sessions, ODVA and advocates voiced frustrations that community college programs were not uniform in their eligibility requirements. While that has been addressed, the main sticking point remains that colleges have implemented the program as it was intended to result in a minimal fiscal impact, which the colleges believed was the legislative intent. Colleges believe that federal dollars need to be applied first. If a student is not eligible or for some other reason does not receive such benefits, they qualify for the tuition waiver if they have in good faith sought federal dollars. Last week, in fact, the House Veterans Committee endorsed the last dollar approach after receiving the Senate Bill 338 Task Force report. The task force discussed the overall goal for the dependents and spouses to have the resources they need to attend college and to not have to wait for federal aid that sometimes is not timely. The presidents discussed waiving late fees when incurred, allowing a reasonable amount of time for benefits to come in, and creating the greatest degree of flexibility for the student as possible. They felt it was important to look at all of the resources available, including Dependents Education Assistance, the Pell Grant, and the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So far, the conversation around the waiver has simply been about whether to have a waiver or not to have a waiver, not about identifying unmet need. I'd like to note here that the use of allocated federal dollars first is a priority for a myriad of programs in Oregon, and this has a very long history. It is not new. State and local dollars traditionally come into play to fill in what federal dollars don't cover. According to the federal code, the Dependents Educational Assistance Program is an educational assistance allowance to meet, in part, the expenses of the eligible person's subsistence, tuition, fees, supplies, books, equipment, and other educational costs for spouse and dependents of fallen or disabled soldiers. The current payment for full-time student is $957 per month when enrolled, and portions of that amount for less than full-time enrollment. The program offers up to 45 months of education benefits. These benefits may be used for degree and certificate programs, apprenticeship, and on-the-job training. For spouses, this also includes correspondence courses. Remedial, deficiency, and refresher courses may be approved under certain circumstances in addition. Additional financial aid available for qualifying students includes the federal Pell Grant for an annual $5,550 maximum and the Oregon Opportunity Grant for an annual $1,800 maximum. One of the policy questions is, if a student receives all of these forms of financial aid, is there a need to fully waive tuition? Currently, the community colleges approach the waiver as a safety net for students not receiving these types of aid as last dollar. If the policy is to change this approach, it becomes an unfunded local mandate at a time when it is fair to assume that our legislature will not backfill those dollars not received or asked for by the student. Our history has been the opposite. It's important to know that the federal veterans benefits, such as the DEA program, do not count as income in determining the student's financial aid package. Full DEA benefits would not reduce the student's Pell Grant or Oregon Opportunity Grant. The Dash 4 amendments would not allow community colleges to apply DEA, Pell, or Opportunity Grant first, though it would apply the Marine Gunnery Sergeant John D. Fry Scholarship, which is another entitlement program that makes education benefits available to the children of service members who died in the line of active duty. However, unlike the DEA benefits, this program is for children of service members who died after September 11, 2011. The average cost of attendance at Oregon Community Colleges is $4,126. This does not include living expenses. This table illustrates the degree to which the OUS and community college waiver programs are currently aligned. DEA benefits eligibility is included for context. In a few cases, colleges appear to have used DEA requirements to develop their policy. Issues covered in the task force include overall goal of dependents tuition waivers to provide a safety net, ensuring eligible students have resources needed to go to college. Federal and state benefits currently available include the Federal Dependents Education Assistance Program, Federal Pell Grant, Oregon Opportunity Grant, in addition to the scholarship that is noted in the Dash 4, the Marine Gunnery Sergeant John D. Fry Scholarship. Additional considerations should be made, such as waiving late fees and allowing students to begin class before federal benefits are received. Issues raised by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs include tuition waiver eligible students should not be compelled to apply for federal benefits or aid. Waivers should be applied first dollar regardless of other aid, and federal dependents education assistance goes directly to students, not to the college. Conclusions of the task force include to answer the question, Senate Bill 338, of what it would take to align community college tuition waivers with the current Oregon University system tuition waiver, colleges would have to move to a first dollar waiver. The presidents recommend applying federal dollars prior to local resources. The policy question before the legislature is whether to apply federal or state and local dollars first. Community colleges have experienced a 21% decrease in general fund dollars during the last 4 years, while at the same time absorbing a 34% increase in full-time equivalency or student growth. This translates to a 41% decrease in general fund dollars per student, a plunge from $2,688 to $1,580 in real general fund dollars per student, because there is no per student adjustment for community college funding, and the reductions to accommodate the enormous growth in the number of Oregonians now enrolled in community colleges. Facing diminishing resources and increased demand, college have administered this program to capture those students who are not receiving other available aid to pay for their education. Looking at all of the resources available and not approaching the tuition waiver discussion in a vacuum, the community college presidents came to the conclusion that federal dollars need to be applied first. Ultimately, this is the main question, the main policy question remaining, and that is before you today.
John, you have comment?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association, representing Oregon's 17 community colleges. And I just want to make a few brief comments on the perspective from the colleges. And I mean, the first, let me first address the question posed by Senator Olson, and in some way to quickly echo a part of I think what ODAVA's comments were on that. The both the OUS and community college policies, and the DEA benefit program use the unremarried. The spouse has to be unremarried, and the federal program uses the 10-year cutoff. The state one passed in 2008 did not, but that's why we do have a couple of colleges, I think, who use the federal standard, which has the 10-year cutoff. So ours is a bit of an outlier in that it doesn't have it, but the unremarried, they have on both, to answer your question. So just briefly, the community colleges, when this bill was first passed in 2008, committed to passing this program on every campus. And I think it's important to note that many of the campuses already had this program in some measure after being asked by then-Governor Ted Kulongoski to create services like this and more opportunities for veterans. At the time, we were told that by the committee that this would that we didn't want this to go to Ways and Means, and it was to be a fiscally neutral program. And as you heard, for the university system, they use an open seat policy. For the community colleges, that literally means a student has to wait to see if the class for 2 weeks or so to see if the class fills or not. And so we went with the last dollar approach. It's easier for the student to plan that way. It's more workable situation. However, I think the problem with that was that for the veterans groups and for folks looking at this, we created an expectation that a bill in the legislature had been passed to waive tuition. But what was passed was a bill that was not intended to have a fiscal impact, and so that was the way the colleges implemented it. But again, I think there was an expectation created that that there was a robust full waiver out there. And so one of the things that that we would ask the committee to consider as we're looking at the program before us in the Dash 4s, which is obviously a much more discrete approach to this that deals with a smaller kind of part of this population, that we want to be clear that we aren't saying that this is the robust waiver that that deals with every veteran that would be under, for example, the DEA program, because I suspect that this issue will come back in the next legislative session, because I suspect there are going to be members of the VFW and other veterans groups out there who still feel like this issue is not addressed. And so on some level, I think the colleges are asking for is some clear direction from the legislature on what approach should be taken. We have taken an approach that it was a fiscally neutral program up to this point. Some of the other issues, just quickly, I think the colleges look at this as a conversation that has happened in somewhat of a vacuum, where we've simply been looking at whether there should be a tuition waiver or not. And what we tried to do in the task force was to look at what all the resources available are, federal, state, local, in the same way that a financial aid administrator, when they package a student's aid, they look at everything from the income of the family to what aid they already have available. And when we put in policy approaches that say whether it will be always applied first dollar or last dollar, or whether we're going to apply a certain kind of aid first, it really takes any of the flexibility out of a financial aid office for their ability to look at what a student's overall aid package is, what a student's resources available are, and makes an assumption that the gap here is
being filled by a tuition waiver. And the conversation that I think also needs to be had is, what are the overall gaps here? What are the barriers here? I mean, one thing that the colleges, especially the small colleges, found very helpful was when we had a funded veteran service officers program, that was very helpful at making sure students understood what benefits they had available and help them get to those. Because I think on some measure we may be having students who aren't aware of the benefits they have out in the world, and we first obviously want to connect those students to benefit. And so what the last dollar approach was doing, and what we were hoping to do by making sure that folks who fell through the cracks of any of these other existing program was to make sure that that folks who were the spouses and dependents of fallen soldiers or those who had become 100% disabled, was one way or the other you're going to get to school. If a federal program doesn't cover you, a tuition waiver will kick in, so that one way or the other you get to attend college. Some of the other gaps that were identified in our task force meeting were, the president said that we needed to make sure that late fees aren't being charged if students are waiting for federal benefits. That accruing late fees while you're waiting for benefits was something we needed to make sure didn't happen. Another was a few campuses who own bookstores had taken the approach of providing vouchers for textbooks as students were waiting for aid to come in. So, as you know, textbooks are a very expensive part of higher education, and so that was another approach and something that we'll be talking about in our next President's Council meeting as something that could be adopted by every school that conceivably owns their own bookstore. But I think it was on some level to broaden the conversation about what the actual gaps are. Obviously, when you're taking, this is a much smaller group, so the fiscal impact is not nearly as substantial when it would have been when the 100% disability group is included. It's a harder group, as I understand it, from ODVA to get a handle on what the numbers really are. And for the university system, what they told us drove the cost was really when the 9/11 and forward eligibility requirement was removed. When you went back beyond 9/11, that was when it started to have a significant fiscal cost for the university system. So those were some of the things that we were looking at as far as eligibility and what the cost drivers were. I think ultimately the colleges are absolutely committed to making sure that that spouses and dependents of fallen soldiers and soldiers who are disabled are able to attend college and have access to do so. But I think the two policy questions left for the legislature and for this committee are whether this needs to be a first dollar waiver, or whether federal dollars should be applied first, or other sources of aid. And then the second, especially as we move forward, and if there are other bills in sessions moving forward that expand this program, whether it's going to be a funded priority of the legislature or essentially an unfunded mandate at the local level. I think of the program we're looking at currently, this would not have a huge fiscal impact. This is a relatively small population. But if we move forward, I mean, I suspect that again, the veterans groups are going to will want to expand this, because this hits a fairly small population. And as we consider to move forward, we need to sort of tackle the question of whether this is a funded mandate or not. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Olson. We just got the fiscal sitting here on my desk here, and you have 17 community colleges, correct?
Yes.
For 2011-13, it would amount to about $3,100 a biennium, $1,500 a year. And for 13-15, it looked like it would be $12,500 a biennium, or $6,250 a year.
Right.
Doesn't sound like it's that big of a bite.
Chair Boca, Senator Olson, that's right. I mean, that's my point, is that under the current under the Dash 4 amendments, this would be a, this is a much smaller group. This wouldn't have a particularly large cost. And so that's right. But I also think we want to be clear, though. We also want to make sure that because we're including, we do have sort of a last dollar piece to this, which is another federal entitlement program. And I have to admit, I mean, it was yesterday when I first read about this other program, the John D. Fry, Gunnery Sergeant John D. Fry Scholarship, that there will be cases where a student comes to apply to a college, and if they have that benefit under this legislation, their tuition would not be waived. And I think for the colleges, we want to make sure that it's made clear that that's how this program under the Dash 4 amendments is operated, that it's not the colleges deciding not to give aid to somebody arbitrarily, because I think there has been a feeling out there that's what's happening. When it wasn't, you know, from the college perspective, it wasn't arbitrary. They all have the same policy of applying federal dollars first. And it's consistent, but it's not arbitrary.
Appreciate your testimony. Senator Haas, you want to make any closing comments or anything? Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 1563, and we're going to stand at ease for 5 minutes so several of us can use the restroom. Thank you.